Pretty full room here and some new faces. Hope everybody's had a chance to meet some new friends and reacquaint with some old friends, fellowship over dinner beforehand. You know, we're kind of a combination of kind of an intellectual and a social group, so hopefully you'll get some food for your mind, but foster some relationships too while you're here. And we know that some of you probably found us from the meetup group. How many of you came in from the meetup world? Okay, great to see all of you guys, and we hope you get what you came for. And you know, if there wasn't enough time to kind of converse, you know, non-formally, informally beforehand, you're free to kind of adjourn to a watering hole somewhere and continue the discussion. I think they try to close this place down about 9, so you know, we used to have like a semi-official after watering place, so we may get back there. But so some of you meetup people want to take charge of that and recommend a place, you know, come tell us afterwards, and we'll announce an official after meetup watering hole. But we do hope everybody gets a chance to meet some folks. For those of you new to us, we're the Dallas Philosophers Forum. We are a 501c3 nonprofit, all volunteer organization. We do take up a donation to defray some of our equipment expenses and advertising expenses and so forth, so we ask for a $5 donation, which Rob here is taking today. And so if you didn't get a chance to make that on your way in, you can settle up on your way out. And if you want to become a regular, 6-month subscription is only $35. So that's almost half price if you're going to be coming regularly, is probably the thing to do. We'll have a lecture for about 45 minutes, and then we'll leave some time for Q&A afterwards and rotate around the right to ask the speaker a question. We do ask that you address your question on the topic of the presentation, not, you know, just some random thing, and that it be a question, not a sermon, you know, that it lead to a question. And we'll try to rotate it around as much as possible so everybody gets a chance, rather than have one person hog the microphone. Those are basically the ground rules, so we reserve the right to enforce those. and you don't want to find out how we do that, so. better you know. Settle up with El Phoenix for your food. That's between you and them, but we don't like to get stuck with that check. So if you did order your food and they somehow miss you, make sure you claim your check before going out. And, of course, be generous to your wait staff. They work hard and deserve it. So I think that's all of our administrative trivia. So to get on to the lights of the evening, we are very fortunate tonight to have Professor Cal Gilson from the SMU Political Science Department. Dr. Gilson is the author of a newly published book, Lone Star Tarnished, A Critical Look at Texas Politics and Public Policy. And so with that fresh off of the press, his topic tonight is going to be in that same general area with the title, The Politics and Ethics of Texas Public Policy. Let's give a warm Philosopher's Forum welcome to Dr. Gilson.
It's great to be here. Thanks for coming. However you found out about it, it's a great group. This is my second time here. I had a book called Pursuing the American Dream come out 6 or 7 years ago, and I came to the forum and talked about them. That's about the half-life of most of my re-invite invitations. It takes that long for it to boil out of the system, I think. But Dale over there has seen... been subjected to me a number of times over the years, and I know that there are other people that I see around the room. John Dale here has accepted responsibility for this invitation tonight. So if this doesn't go at all well from your perspective, John is the one to talk to when this is over.
I told him I did it to him.
but I appreciate very much coming. This is the book that I had come out earlier. In the year, it's called Lone Star Tarnished, A Critical Look at Texas Politics and Public Policy. It is a critical look in the sense of being an interrogation, but critical also of the results of Texas politics and public policy. And so I'll try to talk about that. And I put ethics in the title of the lecture just so that you would feel comfortable that I hadn't been invited under false pretenses. But even eating dinner at your expense over here, I heard more philosophical conversation than I'm capable of. So you won't get too much of that, and you'll get better by listening to each other. But what I will talk about is what brought me to write this book on Texas politics and what the general results were. And only among philosophers do you drink beer as part of your lecture. I appreciate being able to do that.
It makes you more philosophic.
it may, but not immediately. The impetus behind this book is one that I'm sure many of you have felt. If you read the major newspaper of the state, and almost all of us read the Dallas Morning News, and you read the business pages, as I do every morning, I start with the business pages and go to Metro and then go to the front page, and on the business pages, I find that Texas is absolutely extraordinary in terms of economic growth, in terms of business relocation, startup, that the economy of Texas is outstripping the national economy. And you can find stories like that going back five or six decades into the 1950s and beyond. Yet, when you get to the front page of the newspaper, you read that the Texas public schools are mediocre, that they're underfunded, that their performance results are less than the national average, and certainly less than the best international schools. If you look at healthcare, you find that Texas has the largest uninsured population in the nation. The national average is 15%. Our average is 25%. Our transportation in Texas over the course of the last almost two decades has been funded by bond sales. We don't raise enough money for new road construction, so we sell bonds and other forms of debt. Just all kinds of indicators that Texas public policy is failing not just the young people of the state, but older people, retirees in Texas. So I wanted to try to figure out how it can be that Texas is among the most successful states in the nation on population growth, job growth, and economic expansion in general, yet is trailing the nation, and oftentimes trailing the nation very badly in all the major social indicators, education, healthcare, and the rest. And so that's why I wrote this book. And one of the things that I found is if you try to develop the best empirical data indicators from 1950 going forward, that in many public policy areas, education, healthcare, and the rest, Texas has made no progress against the national average since 1950. Over the course of the last six decades, Texas has made no progress against the national average in education spending, teacher salaries, student education results, healthcare, and other kinds of policy areas. And so I wanted to try to figure out exactly why that was the case. And I think the answer is that Texas has a particular view of the proper role of government in society. And it's the view of southern states in general, but Texas has a particularly distilled version of it. If you take the 15 southern states, from Florida through Kentucky, Tennessee, and down to Texas, they tax at 90% of the national average over the course of the last six decades. Texas taxes at 72% of the national average over the last six decades. And Texas tax rates are from 45th to 47th among the 50 states. So the key difference between Texas and even other small government southern states is their tax rates, their revenues in the government, and therefore they're unable to support better education, better schools, better health care, all those kinds of things. And we'll try to go through some of that. And at dinner, somebody mentioned to me that in that book I probably have a thing or two to say about Rick Perry. And in fact, I do. And I even have a couple quotes from Rick Perry that I'm going to share with you to give you an idea of how Texas views the proper role of government. But it's important to say that Rick Perry is only the latest genius to lead our state by these lights. That Texas has had the same view of politics and public policy essentially from the days of the Republic forward. Texas has always had the view that the role of government in society is to be small, inexpensive, and out of people's lives so that individuals can earn their place in society. So the Texas model of government, all through the 19th century, 20th century, into our period, is that government should be characterized by four key ideas. Small government, low taxes, deregulation, and personal responsibility. So government should be small and inexpensive. It should largely stay out of people's lives, particularly on the economic side, not so much the social policy side. And individuals should have responsibility for their place in society. That people generally earn their place in society and have the place that they deserve. And so Rick Perry, in his classic book, Fed Up, if you haven't read this book, your mind is probably still clear, you're not addled. I actually read this book cover to cover. It's about 120 pages long. My synapses did not fire for a good week. So, I tell you, be careful with that book. But if you feel like you've got it, do go ahead and take a look at it. Rick Perry described the Texas political culture and the Texas sense of the role of government this way. He says, "We in Texas are proud that so many of our fellow Americans have sought relief from heavy taxation and burdens of our sister states to move to our state in search of a freer, fairer climate in which to conduct business and live their lives. But keep in mind that there is a reason people want to come here, and we're doing something right. And that is making Texas an attractive place. So pardon us if we don't want to change our ways to mirror New York, California, Michigan, Massachusetts, or Connecticut." Those, by the way, are the richest states in the country, particularly Massachusetts and Connecticut. One more Perry quote before we move on, explaining how Texas thinks in terms of obligations to the community, obligations to each other. And Perry says, "As Texans, we always take care of the least among us. We will protect them, but cannot risk the future of millions of taxpayers in the process. We must cut spending to keep our economic engine on track." Let that sink in. Just think about it for a minute. He says that as Texans, we always take care of the least among us. We will protect them, but we cannot risk the future of millions of taxpayers in the process. We must cut spending to keep our economic engine on track. So the idea of raising taxes in order to provide for the least among us is off the table. In fact, it's destructive economically and socially. That in fact, if the budget is out of balance, you have to cut the balance, because that is to the benefit of millions of taxpayers rather than to these individuals in need. And I think that's a good description of how Texas state government has always thought about its role in relation to those in need. Being in need in Texas is an uncomfortable thing, particularly in light of the individualism and the personal responsibility that is such a big part of the Texas culture. But lots of people see the Texas political culture and Rick Perry's description of it as incomplete at best. There was an interview by Bill McKenzie, who many of you will know, writes for the editorial page of the Dallas Morning News. He is a rip-on society, sort of moderate Republican, so he'll write essays calling on people to come together, bipartisanship, all of that sort of thing, try to reach a compromise to solve our problems. but he was interviewing a historian, H.W. Brands, is a longtime Texas A&M historian who moved to the University of Texas about 5 years ago. He writes books like I read articles once a year, has written dozens of books, and is a very prominent guy. And thinking about how Texas is viewed from outside, he said, we have prided ourselves on our uniqueness and idiosyncrasies, but you only become a beacon state if people from outside see something to emulate. And outside of Texas, not many people look at Texas and say, we want to be like that. And, you know, that's not exactly right, because there are a good number of states who look at Texas and wonder how we create the economic growth and development, how we create the jobs, whether or not our tax rates, in fact, foster economic growth and job creation. So Kansas, just within the last year in its legislative session, passed tax cuts in order to become more like Texas and experience that that growth. So H.W. Brands is a smart guy. I'm not exactly sure that he's right, that everyone who looks at Texas finds something there that they would not like to emulate. I think lots of people in the South and in the Midwest look at Texas and find things to emulate. But I want to suggest some of the things that might not be worth emulating. And I want to begin by describing where that Texas political culture, where that Texas sense of how government should relate to the structure of society and the economy comes from. Where we got the idea that small government, low taxes, deregulation, and personal responsibility are the keys to government's relationship with society and the economy. And I want to suggest that the Texas model, or the Texas way, that Perry and others talked about was conceived and implemented in a state that was overwhelmingly Anglo. And so the Texas sense of personal responsibility and people having the place in society that they've earned through their efforts, their education, and their application to creating value. That if you're poor, it's because of some personal deficiency rather than your place in the social order being a hindrance to you. And so in this book, I describe Texas as an Anglo-Republic from its founding into the middle of the 20th century. And what that means is that the settlement into Texas in the 1830s and through the rest of the 19th century was essentially out of the American South. The first settlement into Texas in the Stephen F. Austin original 300 and the early wave of settlers was about two-thirds out of the lower South, with Alabama being the heartland of that settlement, and about a third out of the upper South, Kentucky, Tennessee, Missouri, those parts of the upper South. And between the Texas War for Independence and the decade following, 1836, Texas gained its independence, 1845, Texas enters the Union. By 1845, the Anglo settlers into Texas were in the process of exterminating the original inhabitants, Indians. And that's a strong word, but there, I almost said there are no Indian reservations in Texas. That's not exactly true. There are four postage stamp size Indian reservations in Texas. One in East Texas, one down in the El Paso area. They are all very small, meaning a number of acres, rather than in South Dakota or in Oklahoma or in New Mexico. What Texas did between the original settlement and 1870s, the middle 1880s on the far western Texas frontier, was to force all of the Indian tribes out of Texas into New Mexico or up into Indian Territory in Oklahoma. But more importantly, after the Revolution, most Mexicans in Texas were forced below the Nueces and, if at all possible, below the Rio Grande. So that in the second half of the 19th century, the Hispanic population in Texas was 3 to 5%. Now we think that there are Hispanic families in Texas that have been here into the distant generations from the original settlement, very, very few, because there was a very concerted effort to take the Mexican lands and force most Mexicans out of Texas, below the Nueces and generally below the Rio Grande, so that in the second half of the 19th century, the low point for Hispanic presence in Texas was 3% of the population, 5% of the population by 1900. And the black population in Texas in 1860 was 30%. 1870, it was 31%, which was the high point. Because there were very few Civil War battles, virtually none in the heartland of Texas, a little bit on the Gulf Coast, and some over on the Louisiana border, but essentially no major battles in Texas. Southern plantation owners, as the Union troops came in to the heart of the South, sent slaves to Texas for safekeeping, so that by 1870, 31% of Texans were black. By 1900, it's 20%. By 1960, it's 12%, and it's 11.5% today. So about a third of what it was at its high point. And the Anglo population in Texas was 75 to 80% from the end of the Civil War into the 1950s. So an overwhelmingly Anglo population with a small Hispanic population, a shrinking black population, because blacks were unwilling to take their slavery roles in agriculture after the end of slavery, were of little use, pushed out or fled, so that the black part of the population comes down from 31% to 11% currently. So that idea of an Anglo Republic is that from the middle of the 19th century to the middle of the 20th century, when Texans talked about Texas, and it talked about the iconic Texan, the cowboy, the independent, strong-willed Anglo-Texas male, they were talking about most of Texas. But that vision, the sort of Marlboro man vision of the iconic Texan, you still hear people talk about Texas and Texans. But Texas today is less than half Anglo. So today, 48% of Texans are Anglo, 37-38% are Hispanic, about 10% are 11.5%. are black. The Asian population is about 4%. And as you move forward into the middle of the 20th century, the Texas State Data Center at the University of Texas San Antonio is a fascinating website to visit. They have just put up population projections to 2050. So based on the 2010 census, they've got population projections to 2050. And if Hispanic migration into Texas continues at half the rate that it was from 2000 to 2010, half the rate it was over the last decade to 2050, Anglos will be 27.5% of Texans. Blacks will be under 10%, continuing a slow decline. And Hispanics will be 52, 53, 54%. So how are we going to teach the Alamo? in 2050, right? Right? Is it going to be heroic Anglos on the wall and dastardly Mexicans assaulting freedom and liberty? Probably not. But this view of Texas, the sense that, that Texas is that the Texas view of citizenship and individualism and how people earn their place in society is not changing to reflect the modern society of Texas, much less what Texas is going to become over the years. And so that view that the iconic Texan, the sort of literary movie view of Texans and of Texas might have been relatively accurate for a century. From the middle of the 19th century to the middle of the 20th century, it is increasingly less so today, but it is blocking our ability to think about public policy and what we need to do to make Texas successful going forward. Texas is very good, or it has very positive achievements in population growth and job growth. In every decade since the Anglo settlement of Texas, it has grown faster than the national average. We hear it every time there's a census that Texas has grown more than the national average, and the presentation is that this is because Texas is such a magnificent place that people are voting with their feet and coming to Texas in large numbers, which at some points in Texas history has been true, but it's less true, as I'll talk about now, than it has been at some points in the past. We are very good at job creation. Anytime you have relatively rapid population growth, job growth follows because services are needed for the larger population, and so you need more of everything. So we have had job growth at greater than the national average in every decade in the 20th century, and in fact, in this most recent decade, we had more rapid job growth than any other large state in the country. Empty states like Utah, Nevada, places like that can have faster population and job growth because they start from a small base, but Texas is a large state. And among large states, Texas has had the most rapid population and job growth in the country in the last 10 years. But that job growth and income varies within Texas in dramatic ways. Texas, in terms of per capita personal income, which is a way to think about well-being, and I throw that in because it's Dallas Philosophers Forum. You probably have talks on well-being, and I don't want to touch your base here now and then when I can. Texas per capita personal income has been above the national average in only 2 years in the history of the state of Texas. And those years were 1980 and 1982. The last big oil boom. Anybody remember what happened in the late 80s to the Texas economy? Crashed. Banks went after it. Everything. It was an economic decline for Texas really quite similar to what we've just been through nationally over the last couple of years. So per capita personal income, Texas has always lagged the national average. It made dramatic gains during the 1930s, the Depression years, because the Depression hit the banking and manufacturing northern centers of the country harder than it did the agricultural south. And so Texas per capita personal income as a percentage of the national average for per capita personal income rose from 66% to 74% during the 1930s. So Texas still very poor, only three-quarters of the national average. 1940s were World War II in its immediate wake, and Texas went from 74% to 93% of the national average per capita personal income by 1949. and has been absolutely flat since for the last six decades. Today, we're 97% of the national average for per capita personal income. So Texas, for all its population growth and job growth, has not seen increase in per capita income at greater than the national average over the last six decades. Is not likely to see advances against the national average in the coming years because income in Texas is so dramatically skewed by race and ethnicity. If you compare Anglo-Texans to Anglos in the other 49 states on per capita personal income, Texas Anglos rank 13th among the 50 states. So Texas Anglos are doing quite well. Not quite up there with Connecticut and Massachusetts and New Jersey and Delaware, New York, the wealthier states. But comparing Anglo-Texans to Anglos in the other 49 states, Texas ranks 13th. If you compare Texas blacks to blacks in the other 49 states, Texas blacks don't do badly. They rank 26th and make 75% of what Anglos make. So 26 is not too bad. But if you compare Texas Hispanics to Hispanics in the other 49 states, Texas Hispanics rank 42nd. And that's the growing part of the population. The shrinking part of the population is Anglos. Anglos do great, but Anglos can't be educated fast enough to higher-end jobs in the Texas economy to carry Texas forward in the coming decades. Because Anglos are 48% today, by the middle of the 21st century, they're going to be 27.5, some number right in there. Hispanics are going to be 55. So do this simple middle school math. If your high-income earners are shrinking as a portion of the population, and your lowest-income earners are increasing as a portion of the population, average income in Texas has to decline. So if you watch median income, per capita income, all those kinds of figures, Texas is going to decline against the national average rather than improve against it in the coming decades. Unless we do things that Texas has never before done and is currently absolutely unwilling to do, and that is to spend on education. The only way that you can change those dynamics, the only way that you can change those dynamics is not hoping, and it's not, you know, the Texas myth, you know, independence, stay in school. It is, let me just go back quickly, and I'm not going to overrun, even though I am a college professor. I'm going to stop for plenty of time for question and answer, but if you go back to the end of Reconstruction, after the Civil War, Yankees win, occupy Texas for a decade, period's called Reconstruction, sort of the North trying to reconstruct the South, Southern society and economy on its own norms, didn't work. And when the North withdrew, Texas wrote a new constitution. I got ahead of myself. It's right after the end of the war, before military occupation, Texas wrote a new constitution in which it acknowledged the end of slavery and set up a system of public schools to be funded by Anglo taxes funding Anglo schools and black taxes funding black schools. Now think of that. Blacks the previous year were slaves, right? They had no wealth, no income, no money at all. So Texas said all the black taxes will go to fund black public schools. All the Anglo taxes will go to fund Anglo public schools. And I think it's not too harsh to say that Texas state government has never been willing to tax Anglos to fund the education of blacks and Hispanics. If you look at the spending on black schools during segregation, it's a half to a third of the spending on Anglo schools. And if you look at the lowest point of Texas per student funding of its public schools, the year is 1972. What happened in Dallas in terms of public schools in 1971?
Desegregation.
Yeah, that is the year for desegregation. So Texas spent in only 1 year in the history of the state, and that year is 1950, right after Gilmer Akins. Those of you who are old enough to recognize that name, Gilmer Akins, is the educational reform of 1949 that modernized Texas public schools and Texas funding and increased spending. In 1950, Texas spent $208.88 per student, and the national average was $208.83. So Texas got above the national average by a nickel, and it so shocked the leadership of the state of Texas that they never did it again. We have never spent more than the national average on education again in the history of the state. And we went in 1950 from 100% of the national average to 1972, 67% of the national average. So as 1954 is Brown versus Board of Education, 1965 is the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which provided funds to schools that would desegregate. 65, the feds are saying, we're going to sit on you until you desegregate. 1971, Dallas and Houston public schools say, okay, we give. We will desegregate. But they defunded Texas public schools from Brown versus Board of Education to 1972, from 100% of the national average to 62/3 of the national average, and slowly brought it back up over the intervening years, the Perot reforms, Robin Hood, all of that kind of stuff. We're going to go through that again. And in the 2011 Texas legislative session, Texas state government cut $5.4 billion out of public education because its revenues were down. So rather than making changes so that they can continue to fund Texas public schools, they cut them over a two-year biennium by 6 or 7%. So we're going to have another tight budget in 2013. Public school funding will be flat. It might be cut a little bit. So obviously we're not doing anything today. And there's no indication that we're going to start investing in our public schools with the idea of ensuring that the Hispanic school-age population becomes a highly skilled workforce 15 years out. And so that's the thing to watch for. Unless Texas begins to invest in its public schools in a serious, determined, sustained way, which it has never done in 150 years of Texas history, Texas will be a poorer state in the middle of the 21st century than it is today. It can't be otherwise, because if your low-income population is expanding and your high-income population is shrinking, the average income is going to trend down. And the only way you can turn it back up is by improving the educational attainment of all of your students, but particularly the students that are doing less well today in terms of education. The dropout rate in Texas is higher than in virtually every other state, and 40% of adult Hispanics in Texas don't have a high school degree. 30% of Texas high school students drop out before they get a high school degree. And so those are very serious problems. So they're problems that we're not dealing with. We're not even starting to try to deal with it. And we absolutely must. There are lots of other things that we could talk about, but I want to draw your attention to one great Texan, and that is Senator Dan Patrick. You may not know Senator Dan Patrick because he's out of Houston rather than Dallas. He was a radio talk show host before he was elected to the Texas Senate. And Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst has named Senator Patrick to head the Public Education Committee of the Texas Senate in the coming session. And so, Texas public education, from Gilmer Akins in 1949 until 2011, was formula-driven funding. So you've got a formulaic amount per student that increased for inflation and population growth. When the budgets were tight in 2011, for the first time since 1949, the Texas legislature and governor set aside the Gilmer Akin formula so that they could cut public education by $5.4 billion. $4 billion out of the classroom, $1.4 billion out of school construction and renovation. And Senator Patrick said the following: "I think it's a change we needed as we move forward. We have to have real cuts. This is a true cut and an entitlement." When conservatives talk about entitlements, that's usually Social Security, Medicaid, welfare, those kinds of things. Until 1949, Texas never thought of public education as an entitlement. It's been an entitlement from 1949 to 2011. And since 2011, it is again no longer an entitlement. It absolutely has to be an entitlement. No matter what you think of entitlements in general, if you don't think of public education as an entitlement available to every student in Texas public schools, we can't make any progress in public education. So with leadership of this quality, I hold our chances to be slim of thinking our way out of our problems. The other thing, teacher pay. Texas has always underpaid teachers. They make today 87.5% of the national average, and almost half of teachers leave the profession in the first 5 years. So the turnover among teachers is slightly less than prison guards, but not very much less. And teacher pay and other kinds of incentives will be part of the solution if we get to a solution. Healthcare. Just a couple of things about healthcare. This is in real flux. I did a talk to the leadership group for the Baylor healthcare system. It's one of the largest healthcare systems in North Texas. It's got hospitals all the way from Midlothian up through the northern suburbs of this area, and they're trying to deal with the number of uninsured in Texas who they have to deal with in some way as they come into the hospital emergency rooms, but also thinking about Obamacare and whether or not the state of Texas will participate in Obamacare. And I don't say that in a disparaging way. Lots of people do, but Obamacare is just a name that people use for it now. So they're very concerned about how Texas will interact with health care reform, because Texas has, as I mentioned, the largest population of uninsured, and the proportion of Hispanics who are uninsured is higher than the proportion of blacks, which is higher than Anglos. So it's not just income, not just educational attainment, it's access to health care that where Hispanics are below the national average. And so the question is, will Texas participate in national health care reform in order to try to get generally it'll be easy to get about half of those who are currently uninsured, and that number in Texas is north of 6 million. So more than 6 million Texans don't have health insurance. And if Texas were to participate in the expansion of Medicaid that is 93% funded by federal funds, only 7% Texas dollars over the first decade, And then it never goes below 90%. So all the new coverage is essentially with federal dollars. And then the other big part of it is a health care exchange for low income but not impoverished sections to get federal subsidies to take on to the health care exchange and buy their own health care. Texas is saying, we don't want anything to do with either of those things. We don't want to expand Medicaid, and we're not going to run our own health care exchange. And that set of decisions is extraordinarily costly to Texas. There are some costs to Texas, but Texas is proposing to leave $77 billion on the table over the next 10 years because they would be required to spend $5.6 billion. So in what part of your life do you leave $77 on the table because you don't want to spend $5.60? Texas is in that position right now. It is inconceivable to me, even though this is Texas, that we will stay in that position. I think that Governor Perry and others will find a way to compromise with Obamacare, and we will take some advantage of it. I'm going to make just a couple more quick points to show you how thin the social safety net in Texas is. AFDC is Aid for Families with Dependent Children. It is now called TANF, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families. This is after Reagan reforms to welfare. So the welfare rolls are smaller. The monthly stipend for temporary assistance to needy families in the U.S., the average in the U.S. is $407 a month. The average in Texas is $154 a month, about one-third of the national average. So the safety net in Texas is exceedingly thin. In all kinds of areas. And I mentioned that Texas has among the lowest tax rates in the nation. And for the last 15 years, Texas has been somewhere between 47th and 49th as the lowest tax burden in the country. Texas taxes take about 4.6% of per capita income. The national average is two percentage points higher than that. So if you take the entire South, which is a low tax, small government, low wage part of the country, the South taxes for state and local government at 90% of the national average. Some northern states, Connecticut, Massachusetts, New Jersey tax at 125-130% of the national average. Those are high tax states. Texas, or the South, is a low tax region charging 90% of the national average. Texas taxes at 72% of the national average. And what that tells me is that Texas could raise taxes. Now you talk about what kind of taxes you'd want to raise. Maybe you don't want an income tax. There would be other kinds of taxes that could be increased to take Texas, say, up toward 80%, at which point they would still be 10 points below the southern average and therefore still competitive for job growth, business relocations, all kinds of economic growth and benefits. So the idea that God set Texas tax rates at this level and no taxes can be increased is just wrong. We are so far below other low-tax states that it would not risk Texas competitiveness to move taxes up a little bit so that we could invest in schools and healthcare and some other kinds of things. But I will end by simply telling you that Texas has the third highest property taxes in the country. So we can't raise property taxes very much. Those fund local governments and school boards generally. Our sales tax provides 80% of Texas state revenues and is at 6.25% with 2% added by local and county governments. The highest in the country is 1% higher than that. That's California. Texas is 11th, and the nine states between California and Texas are mostly only a quarter to a third of a percent higher. So Texas couldn't raise its sales tax very much without being among the highest sales taxes in the country up near California, which leaves you taxes on oil and natural gas. I mentioned the latter half of the 1980s as being a terribly difficult economic time in Texas because the price of oil collapsed and Texas banks and property values followed. In order to try to restart the energy industry in Texas, the severance taxes were cut by about half. The energy sector in Texas is booming today, right? Barnett Shale, Eagle Ford, all of that. So we're talking about being energy independent in North America by 2020, but we haven't taken those severance tax rates back up to their 1980s levels. We could do that, and that would bring in some additional money. We could bring in a little bit of money with a revised margins tax, which is a version of a corporate income tax, but the only place to get real money is with an income tax. If you developed an income tax for Texas that was at the southern average, not the national average, but the southern average, it would bring in $19 billion a year to Texas state government coffers. And if you remember 2011, we had a budget deficit of $17 to $27 billion, depending upon whether you were talking about just continuing spending or adjusting for inflation and population growth. So that $17 to $27 billion shortfall would have been more than covered with some addition for education, healthcare, and other things by a modest income tax. But we're not likely to do that. So where you get money to invest in schools and healthcare and other things is not at all clear. I don't think that you can. I don't think that we will. And I think that that means that the future of Texas is in doubt, because we're not going to do the things that we would have to do to get ready for the world that is coming, and coming quickly. Thank you very much. Now, I'm gonna go to my host here first, and then I'm going to go right back there and over there.
Sure, okay. Hold it close. Let me go back to the margin tax moment. I'm an accountant, so I saw what happened. It was like, I can't believe it. What were they thinking? About 10 years ago, if you made over $150,000 as a business, you paid a franchise tax. And it was not heavy. You know, mine was maybe a few hundred dollars. But some clients were several thousand dollars. Suddenly, all of that went away. Now the level, the floor, is over $1 million. And to me, that was just a real giveaway. And maybe I'm dreaming, but I think that's a pot of gold that was thrown away, given away. You know, to raise that limit from about $150,000, you know, to over $1 million. And also, when they reworked that as a margin tax, they got at all of these utility partnerships that were not paying anything. So that was another untapped, you know, gold mine.
Yeah.
So my question is, is there something I'm missing here?
No. The franchise tax only hit about 1/6 of Texas businesses, and so the middle of the last decade, the Texas state legislature applied its brain power to this issue and replaced the franchise tax with a margins tax that they said would raise $15 billion in a biennium, a two-year budgeting period. It raised under $8 billion. So when they built it in such a way as to be pro-business, to allow loopholes and to take the amount of income a business needed to make up toward $1 million before it hit. So it underperformed by almost half. And the legislature has refused to go back and look at the margin tax and adjust it so that it would bring in predicted revenues. Because they don't want to bring in revenues. They want to be seen as a pro-business economic environment. So they may look at it in the 2013 session that begins in the first week of January, but there's very little indication that they're going to do that seriously. A corporate income tax is a source of some additional revenue, but not nearly as much as some form of income tax would be. Okay.
Curious about some of your numbers. For Hispanics, there's high unemployment, low pay, lousy social services, not very good education in Texas, and yet they're the fastest growing part of our population. I don't understand why they would come here.
Well, because it's much worse in Mexico.
But it's much better in other states.
Well,
stop in Texas.
Because Texas has a significant Hispanic population. And 15 years or so ago, what a person could earn in Mexico was something like a fifth of what they could earn in the United States. So lots of young Mexican men, and then later their families came up to harvest that difference. Now the difference is shrinking, and high unemployment here means that jobs are much less available. So we're to a zero net in migration out of Mexico. As many people going back to Mexico as coming from Mexico. But I mentioned the Texas State Data Center, and their best estimate for in-migration from Mexico into Texas over the next four decades is it'll be slower than it was over the last decade, but certainly won't stay at zero as the American economy picks up. So it's tough for Mexicans in Texas, but it's a hell of a lot tougher in Mexico. We've got, back here.
There have been some projections that the Democratic Party will gain control of the legislature as a result of some of these demographic changes. And I wonder if you agree with that projection, and if so, do you think that would result in any better results in addressing some of the problems, or do you think more the same?
Yeah. It'll be a very different Democratic Party than rural Texas up into the 1970s, because the iconic Democrats of the waning years of the Democratic Party were people like Pete Laney, Dolph Briscoe, Lloyd Benson. The Democratic Party that does come back to power in Texas, if and when it does, I think it will. The timing I'll talk about in just a second, is going to be a largely minority Democratic Party, largely Hispanic and Black, with maybe a third of Anglo-Texans being part of it. But that great visitor to Texas, Jeb Bush, former governor of Florida, said that he thought Texas would be purple, meaning competitive, in 2016. It won't. It's going to take considerably longer than that. It's probably the middle of the 2020s, because although Anglos are 48% of the Texas population today, they still cast 68% of votes in statewide elections, because Anglos are embedded in the Texas economy. They're wealthier, they're better educated, registered to vote, and turn out at relatively high levels. Hispanics are 38% of the population, but cast only 20% of the vote in state elections, because 30% are not citizens. Those who are citizens are not registered at the same levels of Blacks and whites and don't turn out at the same levels, although their levels are creeping up. So the question is, how long will it take for Hispanics to become comfortable voting in Texas elections? For the 30% to become naturalized and then to become registered and start to turn out to vote. It's going to be a slow process. Hispanic votes cast in statewide elections has increased only a couple percentage points over the course of the last decade. If you think back to the Dream Team Democratic ticket in 2002, Ron Kirk, the Hispanic candidate for governor, the banker, spent $70 million of his own money. Sanchez, Tony Sanchez. The Anglo was the former lieutenant governor. Can't remember his name. But they lost by about 12 points statewide. If you look at Romney and Cruz, they lost by 14. So the Republican margin is not shrinking very quickly at all. So it's going to take a decade, probably 15 years, maybe a little bit longer, before the growing Hispanic population increases its voting clout to the point that it can win or help the Democrats win elections. Right now, Anglos cast 68% of votes in statewide elections, they vote 70% Republican. If you round that 68% to 70, 0.7 times 0.7, 0.49, right? And you need 50% to win. So you're 1% from winning a statewide election in Texas just on the Anglo vote today for the Republican Party. Republicans win 1/3 of the Hispanic vote. They cast 20%, so that's 7% for the Republicans. 49 and 7 is 56. There's your margin, because Republicans don't win black votes, and not very many Asian votes either. So it's going to be a 15-year process before Texas is two-party competitive, and longer than that before Democrats return to control if Republicans do nothing, if Republicans don't do something to make themselves more competitive among Hispanics. And they're thinking about that right now.
Back to your Anglo ethic of small government, low social expense, and high individuality, whatever. Wasn't this the ethic of the early United States until the end of the 19th century? And a lot of those entrepreneurial types and wildcatter oil, you know, barons, etc., cattle barons, came to Texas, you know, out of, you know, for individuality. And so we're kind of, you know, what, a half a century or a century kind of behind. Will Texas in general evolve like the nation, the United States itself, the East did, you know, under Teddy Roosevelt and after that? And what's going to make it evolve?
Yeah, it is certainly right. And Governor Perry and lots of Republicans, lots of libertarians, argue that the United States, and Perry makes exactly this argument in that little book, Fed Up, that the United States went off track not with Roosevelt's New Deal, but with the income tax and the Federal Reserve in 1913, because that was government moving to take control of the economy and extract more wealth from citizens through the income tax, and that it sapped entrepreneurialism and individualism and self-help and all those kinds of things. You know, I think that Texas still thinks of itself as an Anglo preserve, even though change is taking place very rapidly in the demography of the state. And so I think change will come to Texas in a very jerky way, as opposed to the smoother development. If you think that the development out of the 19th century and into the 20th century was smooth, certainly from the Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson progressivism of the early part of the 20th century, into Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal. Obviously, you had the catastrophe of the Great Depression, but you did have government moving to try to take a regulatory role in an increasingly urban industrial society, in which people lived in cities and worked in factories and couldn't grow their own food, build their furniture, and take care of themselves as they had on the frontier. Texas is more urban than the nation. The proportion of Texans that live in cities is higher than the national average, but we still have the sort of more traditional pioneer ethic, and I think that it is not serving us well. And it would be nice if we could sort of smoothly transition into some recognition of what the future will require of us in terms of education, healthcare, and other things, but I don't think that's going to happen. There's no indication so far that the Republican Party is evolving its message to Hispanics. It's hoping that George P. Bush is all it's going to take, but I don't think that's going to turn out to be true.
I'd say if we do evolve from our political culture, individualistic and traditional, and say we go to a more moral, structure. Would you think then we would ease up on immigration laws? I think immigration is really so hard that people really don't. They're kind of scared to get high paying jobs. They can only get service jobs.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I think that Texas has always been ambivalent about immigration, because when George W. Bush did his comprehensive immigration reform in his second term, I don't know if you remember, but Bo Pilgrim and some other great Texans took out a full-page ad in the Dallas Morning News saying, let's not get carried away, who's going to pluck my chickens? Because the kind of labor, as you're suggesting, that Hispanics do in Texas is that kind of chicken processing. They're up on your roof in 105 degrees, straight repair, all those kinds of things. So Texas Anglos have been relatively well served by a two-tier economy and are unlikely to change it soon. If you think about the 2011 legislative session, Governor Perry made sanctuary cities an emergency topic so that it could be dealt with early in the legislative session. So border control, sanctuary cities, the DREAM Act, libertarian Republicans or the Republican primary electorate, I guess you could say, is very concerned about immigration. But the business part of the Republican Party feels like it needs that cheap Hispanic labor, so I don't think we're going to deal with immigration in Texas. We're going to talk a lot about it, but we're not going to really try to enforce aggressive border control. Yes, sir.
It's my understanding that a lot of Californians... It's my understanding that a lot of Californians are moving to Texas. And I'm wondering if that's a decidedly liberal state. Is that going to have a pretty big impact on our attitudes about a lot of these things?
It might, but I don't think there are enough of them coming. There are 2 points. One of them, I read an article just this week about the changing partisanship of Texas in the late 1980s, the Reagan era, you remember John Cower was elected in 1960, sort of a fluke. The Democratic Party was still very much in charge. But 1978, Bill Clements is elected, beaten in 82, comes back and wins in 86. And Reagan runs and is very well received in Texas in 1976 and 1980. So there were lots of Texans who had thought of themselves as Democrats. Their grandparents had been Democrats for years, but they voted for Clements and for Reagan, but they didn't change their partisanship until the late 80s. And then the people that changed their partisanship first were young people who hadn't been and thought of themselves a Democrat for a long time. So Republicans were buttressed by young people and by Republicans moving down out of the Midwest in the 1970s and 1980s. There was a very substantial Anglo in-migration to Texas from other parts of the country. Some of those were well-educated, college-educated business people. Some of them relocated their businesses with them. So during that period, there was an Anglo in-migration into Texas to change the partisanship of the state. But that Anglo in-migration slowed dramatically in the 80s and 90s, first decade of the 20th century. So the Texas State Data Center projects that there will be the same number of Anglos in Texas in 2050 as there are today, right? zero growth. No, real numbers. In percentage, it's going to come down from 48 to 27.5. But in real numbers, it's going to be about 11.5 million Anglo-Texans. And so Anglos have a replacement rate of 1.9%, right? So if there were lots of Anglos moving in from other parts of the country, we'd see growth in the Anglo population. We're not going to see it because that movement of Anglos into Texas has been a trickle for the last 15 years or so. It was a very big deal in the 1970s, 80s, and changed the state, but it's not happening. Population growth in Texas, as you heard during reapportionment, was almost completely Hispanic population growth.
Earlier in your lecture, you touched on the Governor Perry's decision not to bring Texas into the Obamacare. It's Obamacare.
Yes.
And my first thought was, well, that's state rights, and, you know, that was kind of a step backwards. But I kind of think that's actually going to be a step forward, because I think the national federal level will do a better job in getting Texans health insurance than if we left it to the statewide people that are in Austin. So what do you think about that?
Well, I think it's good to look on the bright side. I think it would be better if we took the federal funding for the expansion of Medicare. And the way Medicare works is it's just for poor children and the elderly, poor, and disabled. Most of the money is spent. Yeah, right. I'm talking about Medicaid. Right. And that's what the expansion of Obamacare is. It's an expansion of Medicaid.
Right.
And so I may have said Medicare. I meant Medicaid. It's mostly children who don't have very many medical expenses and older people who have a great deal of them. So although it's two-thirds children, one-third elderly, two-thirds of the spending is on the elderly. Many states allow people onto Medicaid at 200, 250, up to 300% of the federal poverty rate. We, I think, go to 133% or something like that, lower than most, and we allow no adults who are not elderly or disabled onto it. So the expansion of Medicaid would bring in a whole population of poor adults, so they'd have access to health care on a regular basis. Your point, I think you're right that Texas probably wouldn't do that if given the option. But the expansion of Medicaid, Texas has to do or not do on its own. It's the running of the health care exchanges that the federal government will bring to Texas and run themselves if Texas doesn't do it on their own. And I suspect that Texas will find a way to claim that they have bargained with the federal government, they've driven them off their job-killing aspect of the program, and now they will accept it. The Texas will claim to have made the federal government comply with their wishes so that they can take the money. But they may not do a program that is available to as many Texans as it might otherwise be.
At the first of your talk, you mentioned some states like Connecticut and New York as being more wealthy than Texas. What I want to ask, and I want to ask two parts of the question, is what is the take-home pay? In other words, they have higher taxes, but they also have higher income. So what is the take-home pay? Is that still different than Texas? Is it still higher? And how much so? And then the fact that we hear that most people with money are leaving places like New York, and maybe they will come here, and they would be Anglo, and they would have money. If we're able to maintain the difference, they will come here in the future. Now, we don't know what the future is going to bring, but that's my question, two-part question.
Yeah, people, I don't need that. So why was I reaching for it? People talk about that not in terms of take-home pay usually, because Connecticut is the wealthiest of the 50 states, and it's about 135% of the national average. Texas is about 97% of the national average, and God's homeland there in Mississippi is about 80% of the national average. So Texas is up near the national average, but people often talk about cost of living. The fact that Texans make 97% of the national average, but the cost of living in Texas is about 91.5% of the national average. So Texans are better off and they're lower than their income below the national average would suggest. And that's true.
Yeah.
And
that's one issue.
Yeah, right. And people living in Connecticut do pay higher taxes on their higher income. But think of it this way. How likely is it that wealthy Anglos are going to move out of Highland Park for DeSoto or Wilmer Hutchins? And why wouldn't they do that? Right? Because Highland Park is beautiful, right? They have brick medians. They have the cool little signs. The high tax revenues is expended on pools and libraries and streets and all kinds of amenities that wealthy people expect to have. So people living in Connecticut, what's the name of that very upscale, just outside of New York City, where lots of financial executives live? Not Greenwich, but
Quincy. Scarsdale.
Any of those places, really. If you think about the most desirable upscale places in the country, and you drive through them, and everything is immaculate. The streets are in good repair. There are flower boxes in the medians, all of that kind of stuff. So wealthy people expect to have all of those amenities in their communities. And so they don't worry so much about the higher taxes if they feel like they're getting the benefit of it in the quality of community in which they get to live. So I don't expect to see people pouring out of Connecticut and Massachusetts and New Jersey headed for Texas. And more importantly, neither does the Texas State Data Center. And it hasn't been happening over the last 10, 15 years in nearly the way it did in the 70s and 80s.
Last question over here.
As a proud Texan, how many Texans do we have in here? Native Texans. I'd like to point out two problems. Concrete examples. This week, United States Post Office, run by bureaucrats, government bureaucrats, you're arguing that we pay more taxes to give them so that they can run those. They lost $16 billion delivering paper. Now you propose that they run the hospitals. That's a good thing, you're saying, and that we give them more money for education. But my second problem with that is we're seeing what happens when the government pours money into college education, college bubble. We talked about it. It costs $60,000 to go to SMU. Costs $40,000 to go to Baylor for a year. The third point, the United States took in millions of immigrants. They were the poorest. We're not racist in the sense that, oh, here's the white line, here's the Mexican line, the dollars are going to go off. If the population goes higher Hispanic, those people are going to make more money. They're going to run more businesses if they're left free without the government piling in. So I would just like to say those two concrete examples of the poor job that the DISD, for example, I'm a graduate of Bryan Adams High School. Their budget this year was $1.2 billion. Nobody wants to send their kids to school there. They want to send, so we need to privatize education. We need to privatize Medicare. We need to privatize the post office.
Well, we've already done some of that. I do think that we should let the post office changes delivery schedules. You know, we don't need to get. I think that we do want the post office, but we also want to have FedEx and the other private kinds of things that can supplement. Obamacare is not the federal government or any level of government running hospitals. The people that run hospitals are healthcare professionals. The issue of where people get money to fund their access to hospitals is what Obamacare is talking about. And both doctors and hospital administrators are very concerned about their reimbursement compensation levels for Medicare and for Medicaid. And so the issue is, how do we get the 25% of Texans that don't have access to health care to have regular access to the health care resources that we have in the state? And I don't think private markets are going to do that. They haven't so far. There's no indication that they're about to. And I do think that there are some initiatives to privatize various parts of public education, charter schools, and Texas now has something like 350 charter schools. Some of them perform very well. Some of them perform very poorly. And public education is going to be the forum in which most Texans are educated going forward. And the thing that made this country successful over the course of its first two centuries is that up until about 1970, we were ahead of virtually every other country in the world in the number of people that we educated, the proportion of our population that we educated, and the degree of that education. And we were more productive than any other country in the world. And over the course of the last four decades or so, we have begun to fall behind in education in fairly dramatic ways now. So I do think education reform is important, but I don't think that privatization is going to end up being a big part of it.